For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. This is the MJA Podcast. Today's topic is another nasty little bug we need to be on the lookout for. This one is a yeast, part of the Candida family. Candida auris is an emerging drug-resistant yeast responsible for hospital outbreaks internationally. So far, it has been an infrequent visitor to Australian shores, but two recent cases in Melbourne have been flagged as a potential harbinger. Associate Professor Leon Worth is an infectious diseases physician with the Victorian Healthcare Associated Infection Surveillance Coordinating Centre at the Doherty Institute. He is also the lead author on a case series published by the MJA, and he is my special guest today. Candida auris, what is it and how does it present?
So Candida auris is obviously a Candida species, so mm-hmm. It's a yeast. And Candida, by and large, are quite commonly identified yeasts. But the issue with Candida auris is that it's a newcomer. It's an emergent pathogen. The other thing with Candida auris is not only is it emergent, but it's also drug resistant. So relative resistance to some of the first line antifungal drugs that we use, and that's what makes it such an issue of importance, is that when Candida albicans, our common variety Candida that we see in the community and sometimes in healthcare, we can use fluconazole, some of the first line and our other first line drugs to treat infections due to Candida albicans. We simply can't for Candida auris. So it presents in a number of ways. It can present with an infection. That could be a localised infection, such as a tissue or a deep tissue infection or a urinary tract infection. Or it could be a systemic infection. And the most common of these would be a bloodstream infection, where someone could be actually quite unwell with sepsis and could be requiring supportive care in an ICU or an equivalent environment. But notwithstanding the infections, there's also the possibility that someone could present quite unrelated to Candida auris and be found to be colonised with Candida auris. And in that setting, of course, there would be no direct clinical manifestation of that pathogen, yet that individual would be at some risk moving forwards and into the future of actually developing an infection due to that yeast being present either on their skin or in their gut. Whilst they're in a colonised state, it's all fine, but there's always the chance that an invasive infection could arise.
And what's the worst case scenario if C. auris goes untreated?
And that's a big one, is that mortality is actually quite high. And depending on which case series or report you read, the crude mortality can be up to about 30% if you have an infection due to Candida auris. And to put that into perspective, if Candida albicans were reported, the mortality would not be anywhere near as high as that. And so we're dealing with very unwell patients. We're often dealing with patients that have a lot of comorbidities, being hospitalised for a prolonged period, but certainly a mortality of 30%, and even some series report higher than that as well.
Is it prevalent in Australia? Do we see it a lot?
No, we don't. And this I think, led us to report these two cases in mm-hmm. Victoria because of the fact that in Australia we've had a small number of cases only. Look, I could count up, you know, less than 20, probably less than 10 cases that have been reported in Australia. We know, for example, in Victoria, we've had, I think, 4 reported cases, 3 or thereabouts in New South Wales and 2 in Western Australia. But the message is that it's not zero, and it's sort of a small number, yet a notable number, because it may be indicative of a change in epidemiology. Let's not forget that prior to 2018, so prior to 2 years ago, we hadn't had reports at all of Candida auris in Australia. Mm. So this is something new. It's something emergent now. And to contextualise a little bit further, if I could, we've seen reports now of Candida auris in about 30 countries across the globe. So Australia is probably one of the latter regions to have had the identification of Candida auris. So we're sort of now potentially looking at the mirroring of what we've seen in other nations in Europe and the US, where there have been some very large and substantive outbreaks of infections due to auris reported in healthcare. So our report is, yes, two in number, small number.
Yes.
We do believe it's an emergent and a new threat.
Is it the first time it's been reported of transmission from one patient to another in a ward setting?
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question. We've put down in some detail the details of these two cases. Certainly it's very well recognised that Candida auris can be transmitted fairly easily from a patient to another patient, for example.
Yes.
Or even transmission from other sources, and the environment itself can become contaminated when a patient is housed in a ward. In these particular two cases that we reported, we found them to be very, very closely related. Likely to there have to have been some transmission, although cannot be 100% certain of that. And for example, we couldn't tell, was there an index case and was there a secondary case? We simply can't tell by the available methods that we have in terms of the genome sequencing and the other methods we use to identify these yeast. But we felt they were fairly closely related to one another. The single nucleotide polymorphism distance was 167, and we would expect if there were a difference that was substantive, it would be of the order of thousands or tens of thousands.
Yeah, right.
The two were unrelated.
So tell us a bit about these two cases.
The first one was a patient who had an underlying malignancy,
right.
Who'd been admitted to a Victorian hospital, and approximately a year or just under a year prior had been managed in the UK and was then brought across to Australia for ongoing care. So acutely unwell whilst overseas, and then ongoing acute care needs whilst in Australia. Became admitted to a hospital and had an episode of fever, and was worked up according to standard protocols in terms of collection of cultures from all available sites, including blood, urine, sputum, and imaging was performed.
Mm-hmm.
And what actually happened was Candida auris was turned up in a urine specimen. Now, this urine was a catheter specimen urine, so the patient had an indwelling urinary catheter in situ, and the Candida auris was identified there. And interestingly, there were no white cells in that urine specimen to suggest that it was clinically significant infection, nor did the patient go on and develop suprapubic tenderness or any other features that would indicate to us that a urinary tract infection was actually present. So we were faced with this situation, okay, we've found it in a urine. It most likely is a colonised urine specimen. What do we do next? So we went further and investigated all potential contacts that may have had a crossover point with this particular patient in the hospital where they were being cared for, and found that of about 73 or so contacts, that one of these actually also returned a positive culture. And the remarkable thing in this instance was it was yet another urine specimen that
yes.
Identified the Candida auris, and again it was in someone who had an indwelling urinary catheter. Now the interesting fact with this second case was that this patient had been a direct transfer from an overseas hospital. So you can see the recurring theme. And the catheter had actually been inserted whilst overseas. Again, we didn't find evidence clinically or otherwise of there being a urinary tract infection. And it was really quite clear this was another colonised urine specimen. So in both instances, of course, catheters were changed and all the appropriate environmental controls were put into place in
yep.
terms of very stringent cleaning. They, in fact, had been managed in single rooms throughout their entire hospital stay.
Okay.
Had dedicated bathrooms. So we're dealing here with something that's quite unusual, but then felt to do some more intensive surveillance, including a point prevalence survey of the ward environment, and found no further isolates. We also looked backwards with our laboratory results and
mm-hmm.
isolates gone by, and found no evidence of this auris having been identified previously, and did a little bit of work in terms of the enhanced lab methods for detection, of course. But they were sort of the nuts and bolts of the two cases at hand. I think it's important to realise that neither of them did develop infection, and in fact they weren't actually treated for Candida auris. There's no role for treating a colonised individual
yes.
Who might be identified to have Candida auris, whether it be in urine or the gut or on the skin. So that's why we would believe these to be a harbinger, and to sort of say this is here, it's present and identifiable, yet quite fortunately this did not give rise to a severe or a life-threatening infection in either instance.
I'm chatting today with infectious diseases physician Leon Wirth about Candida auris. Leon's co-authored paper can be found at nja.com.au. The next print edition of the NJA comes out on the 1st of June, and it is an infectious diseases themed issue. Not surprisingly, it is packed with COVID-19 content. Our website has a dedicated COVID-19 hub, which you can find at nja.com.au/journal/COVID-19. All our COVID-19 content is open access. Back to our chat. So what's your prevailing theory? These two coincidentally arrived with these from overseas rather than giving it to each other?
Good question, Kate, because almost at the concurrent time frame, there were other cases being detected in one of the other states in Australia.
Huh.
So it almost did seem that there was a wave Candida auris cases being identified.
Mm.
It's hard to say that they were all imported, of course, at the same time, and that they all came from different countries and brought Candida auris with them or as part of the care contacts they'd had overseas. But I think one theory is that these two may have had been colonised whilst in an overseas setting and brought it into an Australian environment. And I think the second theory is that there could at least theoretically have been a transmission whilst they're on Australian shores. What we found with these two also, which is an interesting feature, is that internationally there are four main clades or four main groups
yes.
of Candida auris that
yes.
have been described. And we did find these two to be part of the same clade.
Okay.
So that is also suggestive of perhaps a likeness in the isolates as
right.
well.
Where was the second patient coming in from?
They'd come from the Middle East, actually. And these two countries from where the patients had travelled have both had reports of Candida auris prior
yeah.
to this time
yeah.
as well.
Interesting. Obviously, it triggered a whole bunch of actions within the ward. Can you give us a quick rundown of what the protocol would be with those two patients in the same ward? What would that trigger in the ward in terms
yes.
of...
an extensive look-back process. First of all, to investigate each case in its own merits
mm-hmm.
and to look at risks that were contributing and to look at, obviously, the history of travel and the like. But then a look-back process in terms of any patient or any other patient that may have had contact either in a room or in a ward setting, any other shared environment within health, and then to go about an intensive screening process for these potential contacts. And what that involves is screening of the axilla and groin, so it's a skin swab. And this particular hospital where these isolates were found, the decision was made to go a bit further and to actually also screen other clinical sites. So if a contact had a CVC, a central venous catheter, or a urinary catheter in, then additional specimens were collected from these sites over and above the skin screening swabs, which are recommended as part of the look-back process. So really going pretty hard after it.
Yeah.
To see, can we find it? Can we search for this? And in a very intensive way. So that indeed happened. We also spoke to the state health department, who really did a terrific job at coordinating an incident response here
yeah.
to help work through all the issues, and also concerning just appropriate liaison and support from a laboratory end to make sure that the isolates were confirmed. We needed to confirm what they were using enhanced methods, and one of these is use of the MALDI TOF to do so, and also then whole genome sequencing as well. So that's a really, really important part of the responses here as well. And then we moved forwards further to this after the sort of the acute setting, and after we'd found what we needed to. In fact, we didn't find a lot at all. We just found this second patient, didn't find any other contact, did another point prevalence survey of the ward, so swabbed all individuals in the said ward and didn't find any other evidence. Then moved further afield to actually look at formulating guidelines and to take it to a policy level. And that was a really rapid process, a testament to the support of the Victorian Health Department on that front.
Fantastic.
Had all the appropriate people around the table, laboratory, clinicians, epidemiologists as well. And then I must say too, further steps have happened since then in terms of national guidance for Candida auris, and some of the co-authors with this case report here in the NJA then went on to develop the national guidelines, those produced by the Australasian
yep.
Society of Infectious Diseases, which very quickly followed. And I think that's a great example here of where we've had some clinical guidance and policy direction given now in a very early time frame, so that we can be prepared, and that hospitals that really haven't even seen this as an issue yet can indeed have on hand the relevant information and guidance, not just for contact tracing, but particularly for the laboratory methods and the necessary steps required to identify Candida auris.
Do we know how infectious it is in terms of reproductive factor or anything like that? Does it pass easily from person to person?
Look, it does. We know that the environmental contamination has been described, so I think that's one concern
yeah.
that we can identify it if the environment were to be sampled. We also need to keep in mind, though, that it's not perhaps like a respiratory virus or something very, very readily shed and transmitted. These patients also have inherent risks themselves.
Yes.
So they're in a situation where they're often in intensive care or high dependency units. They've got multiple comorbidities, lots of indwelling medical devices, mm-hmm. whether they're central venous catheters or dialysis catheters or mm-hmm. even just intubation, urinary catheters and the like. So there's a lot of risk that's inherent with the patient as well. And oftentimes they'll also have received prolonged period of either antibiotic or antifungal therapy. Now that's a really interesting one in that they've had a protracted period of administration of mm-hmm. an antimicrobial. And that in itself has been identified as a risk, which points us perhaps in the direction of some of the future initiatives that could be used to curtail risk from a stewardship point of view as well.
What does work with C. auris in terms of treatment?
It's obviously not first-line antifungal therapy, which would often be fluconazole or another azole drug. That's out. What's the first-line agent that's recommended is actually from the echinocandin class of drugs,
okay.
and that's usually caspofungin. And that's an intravenously administered antifungal agent. Can't be given orally like many of the azole drugs. So it's generally given in an acute care context. Further to that, amphotericin or liposomal amphotericin is another class of drug which can be used and indeed would be used if a patient were to have ongoing clinical instability or fever whilst receiving echinocandin as a first-line therapy. There'd be a very prompt step to move to another antifungal agent in that setting as well. So the message is no to fluconazole and no to azole agents, but to use up front a second or a third line antifungal agent. And we have to base that too also on susceptibility testing with labs. That's a really interesting question because it's a little bit of an issue that's in evolution. Whilst we can be, I guess, we can have the suggestion of resistance when we look at the MICs that are reported by a lab, the clinical breakpoints are not yet fully agreed upon nor endorsed. So we're sort of moving in a context here of something that's evolving and something that's emerging with a little more evidence and support as we move forwards in time. But it is still important that a lab report the susceptibilities so that the clinician can then be guided. If, for example, an MIC was found to be incredibly high, there'd be a question raised on that as to, you know, are we talking about auris and should we have done additional tests here to confirm that so that we can use the appropriate and targeted therapy for Candida auris.
Is auris likely to show up in a community setting, Leon?
At this stage, very unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd be encouraging clinicians, you know, if you are faced with someone who's been overseas very recently, and particularly if they've had healthcare overseas, that's the big one.
Yeah.
So more than an overnight stay in a hospital overseas. And if that's been in a fairly short time frame as well, so if they've almost come directly or in a short time frame from a hospitalised setting whilst overseas, have a think about it at least. If you turn up a Candida species, at least ask the question, could this be or would this represent Candida auris? But by and large, we're really talking about an acutely unwell population who, mm-hmm. generally speaking, are in hospitals. Be on the sort of proactive front to be sure that all states and regions really are looking for coordinated surveillance activities. We can be front-footed in our public health response. We want to be able to inform clinicians whilst we have a small number of isolates reported currently. We need to know if that's shifting and if there's higher numbers being reported across Australia. I think the other one too is that fungal reference laboratories, we've identified a real need for these. Even in Victoria, for example, just the real need for a coordinated and an expert insight and involvement of a fungal reference laboratory is front and centre when you're dealing with these organisms. And then the final one would just be that antifungal stewardship programs will be another important ingredient moving forwards to see that we can reduce risk, make sure that antifungal therapies and antibiotics are being used appropriately and not being used when they aren't required, so that we can in some way dampen the risk of de novo development of resistant in fungal isolates as well. Putting in place a screening program for hospitals is a really, really key response here.
Yeah.
Hospitals are, of course, already asking questions on admission. Have you been overseas? Have you had recent hospitalisation overseas? And we've asked that for some time concerning other resistant pathogens such as CPE or carbapenemase-producing enterobacteriaceae. But we need all the more to be clear on this as a policy and as a procedure that's in hospitals, not just for the bacteria, it's also for resistant fungi and particularly yeast such as Candida auris.
Leon, thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.nja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.